Welcome to the 10th episode of Curious with Aaron. I have two very special guests today. I have Quivian, who was my first guest on the podcast. And I have Eugene O'Riordan, I think it is,
That's it.
Yeah, lovely. Eugene actually travelled up from Cork to join us today. So thanks very much. Or Kerry, as you might like to say. I think you're on the border down there.
On the border, yeah. My body travelled from Cork, my heart came from Kerry.
There you are, yeah. Quivian first introduced me to Eugene maybe 2 years ago. Actually, it was during COVID. We were out swimming on the beach and you had done a workaway with Eugene down in his house in Ballycotton, isn't it? How did that come about?
I was talking to Owen. No, I wasn't talking to Owen. I was talking to Owen Connaughton's brother, Dara. And I was out on a walk with him one day and I was like, not stuck in Dublin, but I was in Dublin and it was the middle of COVID and there wasn't really much happening and I was kind of yearning for the countryside and something outside of Dublin and a bit of space. And then Dara mentioned that Owen was down doing a workaway in Cork and just something lit up inside me. And I was like, yep, that's what I need to go and do. And I sent Owen a message and he was like, oh, there's this wise and wonderful man living in Ballycotton. And I was like, yep, I'm sold. So I packed up all my stuff on the bike and went down and spent an amazing, I don't know, 2.5, 3 weeks or something. It was a really beautiful experience. With Eugene, we just led a pretty simple life, doing a bit of work during the day, gathering in the evenings for a meal. And it's just a period of time in my life I look back with great fondness, and I was just really blown away by Eugene. It was great to spend a bit of time with him,
yeah,
and learn from him.
And Eugene's house down there at the time, just to paint a picture, it's quite close to the coast. You had a lovely yoga studio that you'd built at the side. And you designed the house yourself, did you?
Yeah. It was an old cottage that I bought back in 1991. So I'd been living in Canada. So when I came back from Canada, I bought the old cottage. Because that's what I always wanted. It was an old cottage and to renovate and that kind of stuff.
What drew you towards an old cottage?
I don't know. I mean, growing up, I think somehow just something about the ancient and the old. I just always felt like that. You know, maybe I had the skills in a way to work from growing up on the farm. You get all these skills, they're just part of it. You know, you're a farmer, you're a mechanic, you're a gardener. You've all these things, and also the parents and all those traditions. Really, when I grew up in a way, farmer was all of these. It was necessary to be all of them. Yeah, absolutely.
So as a farmer, you would be able to apply yourself to many things.
Yes, I mean, if you had to build a shed, you built it. If you had to put a roof on it, you put a roof on it, they were just learned as part of it all, that's just how it was. Now, in a way, you've an expert to do everything. And that's all just also in society. Yeah. It's a bit like that. Everything has become more specialized. I think, as I see it, like that, I didn't know it at the time, but all these skills, I had acquired them without knowing it in a kind of a way.
It reminds me of how your barber used to always be your dentist as well.
Yeah.
At some point. So you go to get your hair cut and get your teeth. Seen to as well from the same person. I don't know how much we'd be willing to.
Nowadays. But
that's quite interesting. So you decided to get that piece of land, an old cottage, and you'd done it up yourself.
You built it out, you had an extension.
And it's a beautiful piece of land there is. At what point did you decide to open yourself up to workaways? And maybe just for some context, could you explain to people what a workaway is?
Well, first of all, workaway is an international organization, and Well, it's a cultural exchange. Essentially, is what I would feel is the core principle. And so you have helpers and you have hosts. So a host provides food and accommodation, and I have work that I need to be done for whatever kind of reason. I can have whatever reasons I need to do it. In my case, it was because of my arthritis that physically I wasn't able to do many things around the garden and whatnot. I knew what to do, but I couldn't do it. And so then the workaway are like, they're the helpers. They are people who want to travel and have experience. And as people know in traveling, so your food and your accommodation is really one of the expensive ones. So being provided from the host with food and accommodation. And so it's an exchange then for a help of about 4-5 hours a day for your food and accommodation. And so after that, then it's like, depends on the helper and it depends on the host how much other encounter you have, say, with the workaway helper. Like, say, as in my case, my interest was very much to really treat it as cultural exchange. It's an opportunity to meet people from other cultures because it's from all over the world. So on it as an explanation, it's like a site where you have you explain as a helper what is your skills and what you have to offer and what's your interest and all that. So there's a whole profile that you create, and then the host also creates their profile. And then you go on the website and you search for the country and the place and the kind of experience that you're looking for or that you have skills for. So anyway, that's how the exchange encounters in a way. Yes.
So then, Quivian, was that your first workaway that you'd done?
Yeah.
Did you sign up to that website with Eugene in mind, or...?
I wasn't even signed up to the website, I don't think. No, it was just through Owen. Yeah. Which was handy, you know. Owen said great things and I was sold. So I just went down. Yeah. And then there was some other, maybe like two others at the time that were doing workaways as well. Yeah. They probably would have been through the books. I was off the books.
You're off the books.
He was getting the brown envelope.
Yeah. A bit of extra food in the plate.
Yeah.
So when you arrived down, what kind of work were you doing with Eugene?
Putting up a fence. Digging out, what was I doing? Digging out a bit of soil so that the water would drain properly from one of the buildings that he had down there.
Yeah.
Strimming the grass, that was my favorite job with the huge big strimmer. Yeah. These type of things. I think it was like general maintenance around Eugene's place.
Were you drawn into that kind of simplicity?
I think I was just looking to do something because I was sitting on my hole for like 3 months. It was like I'd lost my job as a musician. I know days were getting fairly boring and repetitive, and I just wanted something. I wanted to do something about my time, and I'd free time, but no commitment, so this seemed like a good thing to do.
Nice. And I know that like when I was down, Eugene, like you every morning, because you had built the yoga studio that was quite big and had this lovely open glass that you could see into the field beside you and maybe the horizons as well, and you in the morning you participated in some yoga about 7 a.m. 8 a.m. was it?
Early morning yoga.
Yeah.
And then the
evening, you'd done the Japanese meditation. Did you get involved with that while you were down there?
The yoga I did every morning, yeah. Yeah, yoga. Mm. And I remember you were like, all right, 8 a.m. in the morning for yoga. And I was coming from like just being a bum basically in Dublin of dream months, getting up at like 10 or 11. So getting up at 8 was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? But within a day or two, I was getting up at 8 a.m. every day practicing Aikido yoga. Yeah. I don't think we had a meditation in the evening.
Yeah, maybe I wasn't doing the meditation. The last couple of years, I'm doing that in the evening time. As a consistent practice, let's say.
Yeah, because I find it quite interesting, I suppose, just looking at your story, because originally, you grew up on a farm and then you end up now, you know, doing Japanese yoga at 7 a.m. in the morning. It's a bit of a contrast from I suspect how most people in the country who would start out as farmers, the path that they would lead to. I think it's a bit of a contrast.
There's a big gap in between.
How did that come about? How did you arrive at yoga and this kind of school of thinking in your life?
Well, I mean, in a kind of a way, you know, it's like, anyway, you guys are in your, you know, late 20s, 30 kind of thing. So in a sense, the experience is short. You know, like, so from, like, generally, as we'd say, like 18 or so when you finish secondary school and that. So it's not that many years as to have such many experiences or very varied experiences. But when you stretch another 30 years onto that and you start looking back then from, we'd say, 18 to 30, I mean, it's you even can have an enormous amount of experiences and encounters and that kind of stuff. And for many people, they can go just in a straight line, so they don't vary too much left and right. And other people, they can go really very far to the left, very far to the right, and have huge variations. And that's kind of how mine, in a kind of way, went, as like from. And sometimes they're happening to you, and other times you're designing them, if you like, in that kind of sense of you know, like, say, when I left home or left school, then I went and I trained as a PE teacher. And so from that, then I ended up going and working. It was volunteer work with an organization called LARS, so living in community with people with mental or intellectual disabilities. So, and again, I never set out to do teaching. I never set out to do that. And so then after that, I ended up met a Canadian, and I ended up going to Canada. And in Canada, I was illegal at the time, and so construction and all that was my career for when I was there. And then coming back to Ireland, and then I bought the cottage, and I brought like one of these mobile sawmills from Canada, and I started working with wood. So none of these were all completely varied, where I had no training with any of them. And that's kind of it. I just trained myself in all of these. And so, so that then I started studying the yoga as an interest and as a hobby, and they all just develop and evolve in that way as a way of being. But also, I mean, I like, in a way, and I don't know where it comes from. It's like naturally, like everything is what I feel is about society. In a way, they want to like the same. So even if you look at like dating websites, in a sense, they're trying to match people with same interests. For me, it's like my thinking is the opposite. You really want to match with somebody who's opposite to you, because opposites create the it's more difficult. So like if you take like your partner, it's good to have somebody who's opposite you. It's also very fiery in many, many ways. But if you really, you know, are partnered with somebody who is like you in all things you do, in a kind of way, it's a bit boring. We do the same things because we're interested in the same thing. But if it's like us opposite, you're interested in one thing and then the other person is interested in the other, well, then you learn to expand, to become interested in the other and these things. So that's kind of like really where my thinking or my mentality comes from, in a way, is really experience many, many, many different, and also change is the other big thing that people get into the same career as like people who were in college with me. Many of them, they're now retiring from their careers all the time teaching, whereas I've had all these other different ones completely.
Hands in a lot of piles.
Yes. That's what I feel is the thing. But it's also how it is in nature, is like a principle in nature. Is nature is continually changing, and in the sense, and we don't like change. It's the thing we don't like so much. We like to stay, and familiarity. We're conditioned very much. Everything is about conditioning and that. And why people, you go abroad somewhere like that and you up going eating in McDonald's because you're familiar with it. Besides going to eat the local food.
It is a comfort.
This kind of thing.
When you went to Canada and you met your wife, which has a Japanese background, and came to Canada, did you find that, you know, being influenced, I'm not sure how much of the Japanese culture that your wife at the time had with her compared to maybe the Canadian culture, was that quite different than, you know, Irish culture to bring them together? Did you find that you were influenced a lot from Canadian culture in that sense, or Japanese culture?
Yeah, I would nearly kind of say it's opposite.
Yeah.
In that sense, yes. And yeah, much more as like Canadian culture. Not influenced. I don't feel as influenced by Canadian culture. But Japanese, absolutely, very much so. In that kind of way of, like, if I look back and like Japanese are very precise in everything that they do. Even, for example, as talk about like that, like Asian way of thinking, Asian culture, like with Japanese, like when we start to read a book, we open the front page and you read it to the back. Japanese is the back and you read to the front. It's designed like that. And it's a beautiful way to think in that sense of it's like opposite. And so opposite is really, like we do all things. It's like when you get into the car, you always go into the in by the driver's door. When you go into the house, more or less you go in your front door. And so doing things like go in the passenger's door of the car and cross over into the driving seat, or go in the different door to the house. So doing things opposite, they bring balance to our life in a way. Doing all things the same, you go down the same rabbit hole kind of thing. So anyway, the Japanese culture and all that, is so much of it is completely different than what and how they do. It's of course very challenging and bring a lot of turmoil, absolutely for sure, because it's so different in a sense. But then bit by bit, you begin to see and really expands your own mind and your own way of being. That's the beauty of it. But
what is it about? Sorry.
Yeah.
You know, you're mentioning there about like practices about getting into the opposite side of the car or doing things differently. I think, was it you mentioned when I was staying with you about like brushing your teeth with the opposite hand?
Yes.
Like, why should people do that? Is it to break the kind of automatic behavior that we find ourselves in? And in doing that, it makes us a bit more present, or creates more presence throughout the day.
Yeah, yes, exactly like that. I mean, well, it's what I would discover through practice, like with meditation, in that sense that it's like, in a way, it's like with meditation, like you're following your breath, you're listening to your breath, and you're present with it. And then your mind thoughts come in and your mind wanders off. And so the kind of practice is like, okay, when you notice your mind is wandered off, come back to the breath again. And then you wander off again and you come back. So the real, I would say, like the meat of the practice is the coming back. Because that's the part where, like, we do wander off, and that's where with our mind, it really, that's the nature with thoughts. And that's what about attachment is. You get attached to the thought and you go off on the thought and you wander around and you can go all kinds of places, but you're not present anymore. You're wandering off in thought. So the coming back is all the time to the breath, because the breath is always present. Mm. So it's coming back to the present, coming back to the present. And that. And so the repetitiveness of the coming back is breaking this habitual of the wandering off. So it's retraining the mind. So in doing things, so when I do just the brushing of the teeth, there are all these things, they're all done in the same habit. We're so robotic without even knowing it. We think, oh, I'm awoke and all this. No, we're super, 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 super robotic. And so everything, in a way, we are doing, like how we put on the first, the same sock every day first. You know, we put maybe the same hand into the sleeve of the shirt. We do 1,000 things already every morning when we get up in the same routine, but we don't even think about it. We're doing it so. So doing and breaking these is to become more aware, more conscious, so, essentially. More present.
I suppose there's the argument that, like, in having everything automated is a way to maybe be more efficient in the morning and follow through the practices. But you think that, yeah, breaking them is an opportunity to practice presence and bring the mind back to a sense of presence and now.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Yeah, of course, in the reality is, if they all take a bit more time and that, and so unless you're living like a monk, you have a job to go to and a pressure to go to. You cannot be spending all day just doing concentrating like that.
Yeah.
It's a way of training in a sense. So you train in a sense with meditation, but then it's like you want to apply it in a kind of a practical way in the daily life.
Yeah.
And that's just, they're just simple little ways. Or also you find you're driving or you're going to the shop, you'll go the same route, whether you're walking or cycling or driving, there is that. And so every now and then, just to do different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose even an example of that with music is, when you pick up the guitar or an instrument and you just go over what you already know, and it's a very automated process.
Mm-hmm.
But then as soon as you try to do something new, it really sucks you into the present. You have to be so conscious and deliberate about it, whether it's a new chord or a new picking pattern or just like learning, stretching yourself. Mm-hmm. Do you find that?
Yeah. Like the easy thing to do is just to play what you already know, because it's automatic and it's not, I don't want to say struggle, but yeah, there's definitely less kind of conscious thought that goes into it.
But in a kind of a way, it's almost like contradictory in a sense now. But in a way, you practice to repeat so that it becomes automatic, I'm saying, well, you do these practices so to be the opposite. Because that's the sense of like the more you practice and you do the thing, it becomes automated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
What's the benefit of people attempting to do things differently in their routine, and take themselves away from the automatic behavior? Like, why should people do that?
How I understand it, like these principles in connection with yoga, they come from nature. So nature is always, like, we are very subjective and we are very emotional and this how we look at things. Nature doesn't look and doesn't behave like that. It moves in a sense as like from a point of view of like energy. And it's always making effort like to be in harmony. This is the essence about nature. It's all about moving and creating balance. When there's imbalance, it really wants to create balance. And so the nature is really constantly changing, constantly evolving. And that, so we don't like change. We really want these patterns. We feel comfortable. That's why I say, like, you go abroad and you go to McDonald's because you know what a McDonald's is like. They're the same all over the place. That's why they're so successful in a sense.
Yeah.
That you go and like that, because we talked this morning a bit. You said when you went to Thailand, and anyway, you can say what you did and how you did it. It's an example.
Yeah, well, I was just talking. I don't know how this relates to what we're talking about, but I went to Thailand for like 2 weeks. It was like my first, traveling holiday. And instead of getting stuck in and doing kind of stuff that the locals did, I was over with like a group of lads, basically. And we just went drinking every night for 2 weeks and we hung around with other tourists that were doing the same thing. And at the end of the 2 weeks, I was just like, could have done that anywhere. I really didn't get a unique experience, but like Eugene was saying, I suppose it just fell into habit and that's what was comfortable doing at the time.
A collective habit as well. I think that's one of the negatives of maybe traveling with a group of people, because you end up doing what the group team is or what the group want to do, and you find yourself in this comfort of just having your pals around and maybe not stretching yourself so much, as opposed to when you do travel by yourself. Like you travel to India by yourself, to Dharma and Michelle, and then travel on a bit.
Mm-hmm.
To compare that to your Thailand trip, being by yourself, did you find that you got much more immersed in the culture and went on the piss every night?
Absolutely. Yeah. Traveling on is great. You kind of get to depict really what you want to do rather than following everyone else. But yeah, it was two completely different trips.
Yeah.
And definitely look back on the 7-8 weeks in India a lot fondly, in a fonder way than I look back on the 2 weeks in Thailand.
Yeah, but there's a sense about the Thailand as well, at the point I'm sort of making in it or averting to is habit.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the part in the sense that we're like when we repeat, it becomes like habitual, and it has of course its place. Like say when you're like learning a song, it's really to incorporate it through repetition and repetition or anything. You're driving the car becomes habit, and so it is to become routine. But that really also makes us robotic. And so that's the part, and but also kind of recognizing that, like change stimulates. It's like if you're doing in the same way, energy is really going down, and it's like change stimulates. It shakes us up, and that's a principle. Nature is continually changing, so it's a principle. So it's the same if we look with doing things different. We also stimulate. Of course, it brings more difficulty in these things, but you're learning new things. You're stimulated. Change stimulates, and it gives us this energy as moving energy and vitality. That's the basic essence. We don't like it as a kind of, we're conditioned in a way because we want, as things become familiar, it's some super comfortable.
Is that just not a historical kind of component of our survival to preserve energy? You know, like you find yourself in an automated behavior, you spend less energy, you preserve energy, as opposed to, I'm just trying to think about what life would be like without any habits. Say like you didn't form like habitual behavior and every day you woke up and every decision and action had to be like a purely conscious one. I suppose there's pros in that because you'd be forced into presence. And it's kind of like that actually when you do travel. To me, that's one of the draws of traveling, you know, because you're moving around different environments so regularly.
Yeah.
And each day is like so different that you really aren't afforded the same automatic behavior that you would get from being in the same environment at home.
Yeah.
So you're just like sucked into the presence, which is kind of a liberating feeling, you know, because you're not in your mind or thoughts. Would you feel that when you were?
Oh yeah, well, like if you're traveling, you're in somewhere new every day, meeting new people every day. So yeah, like Eugene was saying, it's stimulating. Yeah. Yeah,
travel is doing that for you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in naturally.
Yeah. It's just ingrained into it. Yes. You don't need to take like a different walk home. You just have to walk home because the walk home is going to be different and new and exciting.
But it's like when I'm listening to you talking in a way about like consciousness and presence, it's almost like as if it's something we have to do or a problem. No, if we were in that state, we would be in absolute bliss all the time.
Yeah.
In that sense, if we were in a sense of presence and consciousness and awareness and continually changing, we'd be in absolute bliss. Our suffering comes from resistance to change.
Yeah.
Like it's like, okay, if some loved one or a partner or whatever, you know, like a relationship breaks up, for example, or somebody dies close to us or whatever, it puts us in turmoil. We suffer. We're grieving. We're at loss because it's simply they're gone, you know, and that's it. So
like,
we have to adjust to it again. So like in that sense, and because things are changed, it's just simply a change. I'm used to being you around. Now you're not there anymore. So my life has changed completely. Like it's a big shock. So the suffering in a way is to readjust again. And after a period of time, you're moved on into the new thing. But this, the change is a shock.
Yeah, the unknown as well. Yeah. But that change can also occur, I think, internally as well. Kind of, you know, like if you have a day or a week of feeling joy and flow and then all of a sudden there's a shift in energy, you can be like craving how you felt a few days before or a few weeks before, thinking about this period where you felt, you know, you're your best self, whatever that best self is. And now you don't feel so good. So you crave that older version of yourself, that resistance. So basically what you're saying, but it can occur from an internal relationship with ourselves too. Which is, I think, you know, as the Buddha said, that's the root of all suffering, isn't it? You know, like it's how we think about certain things. Have you, you know, I suppose I'm curious, about like your introduction to yoga and meditation, you know, in the early 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
At the time, that probably would have been quite under the radar or, I don't know, outside the traditional ways of health and fitness.
What? Oh, yeah, completely outside of that realm for sure.
How did you get introduced first, and what was your impressions or initial thoughts? Did you have skepticism or was it your curiosity that kind of maybe just allowed you to spend some time with it?
No, accidental, I think, might be more precisely way to put it in a sense that... Well, it was a period in my time, where I call it like a crisis in my life, you know, and that this is often in a way like a crisis are absolutely super times in a way to stimulate change in a sense. And well, also as well as that, crises are they're like it's a way of life showing you need to change. That's the that's another way to look at crisis. But we have a big resistance about crisis and stuff like that. So a crisis as was like a separation period with my wife at that time. So she went back to Canada and I was in Ballycotton, and so the at that time three children. So, yeah, absolutely. I totally, the dream in a way had really sort of blown up, and I was there on my own and so suffering like absolute crazy, the whole sense of grief and loss and everything. So that time a friend of mine was involved with yoga and these things, and there was these two guys coming from Italy for a yoga seminar, so to come along, and there was one of them who had an experience like say with separation with his wife and he was also a student of shiatsu and stuff like that. So yeah, good to meet him. And
what's shiatsu?
Shiatsu is it's an oriental therapy in a way, like it's called like how do I say it? It's pressure, applying pressure to meridians and vital points in a way to really connect with life force and move energy through the body. So I went to the yoga and it was all fine and whatnot. And then the next day I had made an appointment to have a shiatsu treatment with this guy. So he's a Dutch guy but he was living and studying in Italy with this Japanese Zen master. I went in, chit-chat, okay, lie down there, and then I was lying down, and really during the treatment, I just felt something. It was just very simply, whatever the fuck this guy is studying, this is what I've been searching for all my life. And I mean, at that stage, I was about 30, I think, just something. And it was a kind of an essence of I felt something. But just through the contact, through the touch, through the breath, and then also something he said about like visualizing my children, because again the loss and the grief of the children was huge. But like visualizing them, and I really felt like
When you say the loss, sorry, just to clarify for context, the loss of your children, like you mean like your wife at the time she returned to Canada.
Yes.
And the children, they chose to go to Canada and you stayed in Ballycotton.
Yes.
So the loss was just like the separation of...
Oh, yeah. In that sense, yes. Yeah. Separation, yes. Not losses and death.
Yeah.
But it is a kind of a death in another sense.
For sure. And the ending of a relationship is a death in itself, you know, because it's the death of this kind of unique connection that was shared amongst two people. And I think it does elicit kind of similar physiological responses to losing someone, you know, the same like grief response, which is something that's not really explored, you know, too much. I think when you hear of people ending a relationship, it tends to be something that you kind of keep under wraps or you don't talk about, but it's a quite intense.
It's super intense. That's what brought, I would say, the crisis.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. But so this treatment, in a way, so really, I really felt something in that moment. And so then it turned out that that was on a Monday night. And then there was beginning a week later, this month-long training called Life Encounter. But at this dojo center where the Japanese men lived. So on the following Sunday, I was in Italy, just absolutely like that. No idea, nothing, what yoga, no experience. I knew nothing about
yoga.
So you
flew to Italy for this?
Yes, it was 1 week later. Because I felt whatever through this treatment, through this, whatever this guy was studying, this is what I was looking for. It was enough. It was really based on no knowledge, no nothing, whatever. And so I was there. And so then I had this 1 month of study, like I would say the most incredible month of my life in a way.
Really?
Yeah. You have no idea what you've entered into, and then you participate. And
you took a leap?
Yes, it's a complete leap in a way. Yeah. But it's like, it came as from inside. I felt it like that, and I just went, and then that was the beginning of it in a way of, just like when Kevin spoke like about arriving down to me, and then suddenly there was practice at 8 o'clock in the morning, and he was used to that. The same thing. It's just we're accustomed to our routine and our habit, and then another one, it shocks us. And so this was wake up at 6 o'clock and yoga at 6:30, running for the first hour of the morning, and it's practice all day until like 11 o'clock at night, and then you have to write reports, and you're in bed at 12. And
wow.
Yeah. So all crazy things, or even sometimes there was like stimulations, like you're exhausted and you go to bed, and then at 2 o'clock. They wake you up again for the middle of the night to do practice.
2 a.m.
Yes. Wow. To do a laughing exercise.
At 2 a.m.
Yeah. After you've just been exhausted and you're going to bed and you're woken up, and are there things like already the food is not so much, but then you wake up at 6 o'clock and okay, the breakfast is around 10 o'clock. Not a very big breakfast, but then some morning you'll come and say, oh, there's no breakfast today. And you just have to go on, or practice is like you practice all day, and then at 10 o'clock, okay, we're going to do an all night walk. So you walk all night until the morning. But then when the morning comes, you continue as if you were sleeping all night. It's not that you come back at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning and you spend sleeping until 12 or 1 o'clock. No, you go on the next day, having missed the one night's sleep.
Yeah.
So all these kind of like I would call them just stimulations, but the essence about them all is to break your habits and break your attachments. That's the essence about it all.
And
your beliefs, your attachments, your beliefs really.
Yeah, it sounds like it's to also test your equanimity, and that's like you're trying to stay composed to frictional stimuli such as being woken up from a sleep at 2 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
For the most part, I think anybody getting woke up at that time wouldn't feel very joyous or happy or up for doing a laughing session. But kind of reminds me of the Vipassana, at 4 a.m. they walk around with the bell. They just like do the dong.
Blessed bell.
Yeah, it becomes a bit of a time warp, after a few days, and you're just hearing it every morning, and you have to really just practice accepting the bells and noise and not getting too carried away with it.
Mm.
Did you find that with the Vipassana that was irritable?
The lack of sleep just killed me, yeah. Because you're only getting like a 6-hour window to sleep or something like that. And I usually have to lie in the bed for like an hour or something like that. So you're getting like 5 hours max sleep every night, So that was tough.
Yeah. And that was quite a leap for you as well.
Yeah, getting up at 10 or 11 to getting up at 4:30, that's an even bigger leap than the leap I had to make going out to Eugene's, you're there, and like the first hour or two you're sitting, but you're just fighting back the sleep for the first hour or two. I just remember that first hour or two, you're just doing all your best, sometimes you get up and walk to try and get a bit more energy into you, For that first hour or two, very sleepy. But then you get your breakfast, and I remember there was a big vat of tea. So I just take you two huge vats of tea, a cold shower, and then the rest of the day I was fine. Mm. But yeah, it does, but does
like,
test you.
Like with these, my understanding, like in a way, or well, my experience also, is that it's all in a way to break. Just no different. This is what I was talking about, like brushing with the teeth or with the left hand or getting in the other side of the car, like doing things. They're all like training myself this part about breaking habits. That's what I discovered in all these. They're very strong practices. And for sure, you don't feel much joy or much. You wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're tired. You're fucking angry. And it's like the practice might be laughing exercise. There isn't much to laugh about. Or also you discover you're starving, hungry, and you discover like, fuck, no breakfast. You're pissed off and you have all kinds of things. This is what comes up inside. But because that's what I'm feeling. That's what is. This is putting me in contact with what's already there. And so you discover through doing this number of times, well, actually, without the sleep, actually, I manage fine. Without the food, I manage fine. So it just breaks the attachment. So like I can say certainly, as I talked a little bit with you last night, like with sleep, if there is sleep or no sleep, it doesn't. I don't care nothing in that sense. If it's like, if I'm up all night, I know I can go on the next day. I'm not, so that's what I mean. I'm not attached to sleep in a sense. You know, okay, I mean, I have my limits, of course, in that sense. But as in normally, like if we stay up chatting and if the energy is flowing 3 or 4 o'clock, even if I have to get up at 6 o'clock, it doesn't bother me in the sense like that. So that's what the training has done to me. Or the same thing as if there's no, suddenly it's like, oh, there's no breakfast. It's fine.
Yeah,
so I don't go into the rage and the anger and all the blame or what the hell. Oh, I know I will be fine without. So that's what is helping me, is to break the attachment.
Yeah. Is that what creates a lot of the misery, you think, for people like who get a lack of sleep or don't get fed at a certain time? It's not so much the physiological response, but it's their association to the impact that it will have on them or what it means to them.
Well, as my experience, like when those things, you're woken up in the middle of the night, I'm absolutely raging, furious, angry. Now, if you do to me, it's absolutely fine. I can laugh. I can enter into the practice.
Yeah.
So because I have changed my, this is like you said earlier about like turning to the inside world. Like that's the part of the inside. That's what's there. The rage and the anger when things are, disturbing me, if you like. So that's like going into the dark jungle. And if we talk about our dark side and our unconscious, there's so much of that there. And so you take a look at it and you realize, it's there. So can I sit with it? And so you accept in a way, it's like, so like you go into the dark jungle and you're terrified of the dark jungle. But can you sit there and actually feel the fear or feel the anger or feel whatever it is, we'll say, from what we might call our dark thing or the shame or like this. So it's kind of like that. So all these put me in contact with them. And so then I realized through many times, not just once, many times of being put in contact with this part of myself, because essentially that's all it's doing. It's bringing me in contact. So whatever comes up, it's coming out of me. But in society, it's you made me angry. And so, boom, it's really directed really at you. And so when this is direct, it's like shooting a poison arrow. You feel it in a way. I mean, the extreme is that I punch you, but I don't have to punch you to really you feel blown away by somebody's emotion and stuff. So this is all pumped out. Whereas in that sense, it's created inside me. But we're conditioned that life is happening outside, and so it's your fault. There's something to blame. So the whole essence about this is taking responsibility.
Yeah.
And so then I can do something. If it's you who make me angry, there's nothing I can do about that. I am powerless because it's you. But if it's I am creating the anger, you're just a trigger, but I am the one who's creating this inside me. Now I can do something about that because it's inside me, it's mine. So to me, that's the most central essence part, is we need to take 100% responsibility for everything. My health, my well-being, my mental state, everything is like that, is 100% my responsibility.
Yeah.
So that's really embracing life.
That's what the Stoics would say as well, isn't it? It's like very much part of the Stoic teaching that, you know, like absolute responsibility over, you know, health, wellness, and spiritual, internal, I suppose, rhythms.
Yeah, but I mean, in a simple term, is like, who's responsible for your life? I mean, it doesn't have to be like some big spiritual thing. I mean, if you think about it in a way, who's responsible? I mean, if you're not happy, who's responsible for it? It's like our any action. It's really, this is my life. I mean, if we want to think in this short moment we are here on this planet, in your life, it's completely yours to do the hell what you like with it. Yeah. It's really yours in that sense, and it's all up to me to do it. But we're conditioned. This is the problem. We're conditioned the opposite. And so all this work to try to be free of that is to realize, absolutely, this is all these beliefs and ways of thinking of what I am and identities and what I can do, they're all put on me through the socialization process and whatnot. And most of them, they're really not true in that sense. So to be free means to make contact with this inside world where it's really quite different as how life is moving, and that. So to me, that's the key to take responsibility and to begin to feel, this is my life in a way. So it's up to me in a way whether I want to be happy or not happy. It's completely my, I can control and I can decide this.
What are you going to say something?
Yeah, I just had a question to ask Eugene. It's one that popped into my head. You're like one of the most grounded and like centered people I've ever met. Were you always like this? Or is it true, like your experiences with Aikido and all of these different things you've come in contact with, that has helped cultivate the person who you are today?
Yeah, I think absolutely. There's no doubt that the contact with the Aikido yoga is a huge part. There's no doubt about that. In a sense, as well, it's like it's a tool to that really put me in contact with myself. It's essentially like I'm not a very big reader. And are also following podcasts are not like that. It's like that. My kind of thing is, and this is really what I got from the Japanese guy that really I studied with in Italy. It's just, he had no interest to train teachers, yoga teachers or shiatsu therapists. He wanted to change researchers or train researchers. So in a way, to instill this part, to become a researcher of life. So a researcher, it's a particular attitude. You want to find out. So curiosity to find out. And then the other big kind of teaching in it also is to verify. Because nowadays you hear coffee is good, coffee is bad, butter is good, butter is bad, oil is good, is bad. This expert is this, that expert is that. And it's like, I mean, at the end of the day, it's like your total confusion and disagreement. So the part is to verify means you find out for yourself. I mean, you have it all now with all the, you know, the technology, all the different information. And it's like, okay, you have to find out, you know, what's truth and what's lies, and you must try to go to the source to find out, okay? It's the same thing in a way, to verify. And so through yoga and through this part is through your experience, you verify. So that's really how my approach with myself is. So if it is something about breathing or about posture in how you sit, you develop the sensibility, because the intelligence of the body is enormous, huge intelligence. The body has all the information from the beginning. is all passed in the DNA, like so, all of this. But the problem is we have gone to concentrate too much and to put too much on the intellectual part with a total no attention to the body. So it's all about the intellect. And of course, the better the intellect, the more money you can get. And it's that world. But this is all then denied, all the intelligence in the body. So for me, in that sense, it's really to come back to make contact with what's already there. You know, and it's like just as an example about that with the body, which we talked a bit last night, is like if a dog is having pups in a way or giving birth, like they don't need a midwife, they don't need to read books, they don't need to go to the hospital or whatnot. Yeah. They just know. And also how to mother them and all the rest of it. They know. Mm. And so why do we need such a big entourage of things around it, you know? With respect, there are complications and this demands thing. I'm not denying that is everything like that. But as a general flavor, we have lost this contact with what is natural within us, as a sense, because we are evolved more than an animal in a sense, are supposed to be in that sense. So, but that's to say, we have sacrificed this contact. So it's from there, I feel, to go back in to train the body to find. It's all the information is inside. There's nothing new coming. It's all there. Mm-hmm. It's just to wake it up. As I don't know if that answers the question, but...
Yeah. I was just trying to get maybe a sense of, like, what was Eugene before,
before
he discovered all of this, I can't ever imagine you as someone other than this, do you know?
Yeah. As before. Oh. Well, I suppose some part, like in that, like growing up, it was a very simple lifestyle. Mm. If to go back in that, well, my parents had no education since past primary school, for example, and that. And my growing up was on a small farm. So when I was young, it's like that. The work was done on the farm with the horse. It was all done with the horse. The cows milking by hand. So like even when I was, you know, 5-6 years old, I was milking cows by hand in a way. So in that kind of way, that contact with the simplicity of life has been, I've grown up in that. Where, you know, everything was just grown organically. There was, the word organic wasn't even mentioned, but everything in a way was, because there was no artificial fertilizers and chemicals used. It was just horse shit and cow shit in a way. That was it. So it was completely natural. There was no injecting animals with nothing. So that was the, I suppose, if you like, the roots of, I mean, grounded. You're really, you like, you're playing in shit every day, if you like, in a kind of way, or you're that in the earth. And it's all fine, natural. There's no preoccupation with, oh, wash your hands or bacteria or all that. And
not a lot of distraction either, really, is there?
Nothing at all is about fears around any of that. And it's like, I was never sick as a child. My mother, I have no recollection of my mother ever being sick. In a way, as you have flus, colds, and, you know, in bed for days or nothing like that. So all that kind of simplicity of life, of, you know, doing things in that way. I mean, it's gone completely now, but it's not that long ago in a kind of a sense. So all that, and there wasn't too much, if you like, stimulation of the intellect. I mean, the television in a kind of way just came later in life, and it was just watched very little in a way. There wasn't loads of channels or nothing. So there was loads of not stimulation. Now, in a way, the stimulation coming at is just so enormous. It's too much information in a way. So maybe that might be in it in a way, the absolute simplicity, and there weren't too many things complicated. Mm. No different. You've been traveling in Asia and these parts and also like that. I mean, I haven't been there, but I imagine that's the kind of life. And that's my interest to go there, is to come in contact with what I feel is the life I grew up with. Mm-hmm. So and you can tell me, or you can tell from there, as the like, let's say, the vibration or the sense of community or the happiness that the people vibrate. So
yeah, there's definitely some parts of Asia that won't be that simple and not stimulating of the nervous systems. There's definitely cities and stuff like that.
But if you fly into Bangkok, the opposite.
Huh? Bangkok or Delhi, that's quite an assault on the nervous system.
I was thinking more towards the countryside and the rural communities.
So it's your plan. Your plan is to leave in the coming months. You're gonna get a one-way ticket and go for 6 months Southeast Asia by yourself, solo travel. Is there any sense of intimidation about going and doing that by yourself? And you haven't really got a robust plan. I think your thoughts are just to kind of land maybe one place to go to and feel it out. Where are you at the prospect of doing that trip?
As I kind of started thinking about it maybe 3 months ago or something. So in the beginning, there was a little bit. But I kind of quickly observed the fears and the anxieties. They only come when I start doubting myself. It's like that, okay, because with my arthritis, okay, I won't physically be able to do this. And I start to think about, let's say, my lacking and what I might not be able to do and difficulties. When this thought and this thinking comes up, absolutely, it feels like a big mountain to climb. And I start recognizing that, okay, stop. What I can't do, I can't do. It's no different than here at home with whatever, or for anyone. We have our limitations and we accept the limitations, then that's the limitation. But then there is a whole other big world of what I can do and where I can. And so when I start putting my energy in there to that part, I start to feel so excited and so positive. All, if you like, what I have to offer as opposed to what I haven't and I can't offer. Once I became clear and understood that, how it's going on inside myself, the way I orientate and my thinking comes up consciously, unconsciously, whatever, is like, actually, no. And so then it really switched to be much more curious and like open. And also, I mean, like, that's as we get older, if we're following down the one channel all the time, of course, afraid of like, oh, I can't do, and all the world starts to become smaller. But I really kind of really feel I'm like a 20-year-old again in that sense. And maybe not energetically of running around or partying and all that kind of energy, but as a kind of curiosity and openness and excitement, as like, I have no idea. You know, like when you go off in your youth, like you're just glad to be out the door and the whole world, and you're fearless of the world in a kind of way and excited by it. That's really what I feel I've cultivated or trying to cultivate, is with that kind of thing to go off, and it's just exciting. So it depends in that kind of way, what kind of world do I want to cultivate inside myself or cultivate? The one of fear, absolutely, I won't go near the place. But this other one is just excitement. So that's what I really feel, that this is really my thinking and my attitude and what I cultivate. Of course, it's also coming as what I feed in my daily life. If you really feed all the news, it absolutely is terrifying. It's all feeding all the part of terrible fear. So that's paralyzing. The same way as if I go back to that experience in the beginning, if I think about, oh, my lacking and what I can do and I fear, it paralyzes, in a sense, as resistance to go. But really, when I accept that, okay, that's the limit. But then there's the whole other one. It's total different energy and total transformation. And so that really, I understood that and became very clear with that, say, with my arthritis. So I'm, as any people won't know, but I'm quite crippled with rheumatoid arthritis, which anyway came on about like 10 years ago and almost died in a way because of the arthritis, because I didn't want to take medication. And so it came to a point, and what I discovered is as there was like a transformation point where I was dying, then to start to come back to life.
Literally, actually, you could have died from it.
Oh, without any issue, I was dead almost in a way. Like,
really?
Like 3 days or so, I couldn't even, I'd have to be lifted out of the bed. I didn't have the energy to lift myself up. And
that just kind of came on, was that?
Well, it came on over a period of time. That took 5 or 6 years to get to there.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so, quite scary to lose the ability of your...
No, it was literally like, in a way, I was at a point where I thought I would never leave the house again and that I would need constant help, in a way. But the essential ingredient, and I wouldn't say the essential ingredient, but the mindset, let's say, of that condition, it's all about the loss of, I mean, I was a vibrant, energetic young man, in a sense, really the energy, even that I, like, so when it came on, we'll say like I was in your early 50s, like that. But really, I had the energy and everything of a 30-year-old. But in a short space of time, over a couple of years, it made me into like a 90-year-old, was a transformation. But so then mentally, it was all the energy was going, what I had lost, what I can't do anymore. It was like a big, massive grief. All of all this loss of, you know, like... would say physically where I can do it, work, the identity with all the work, the ability to income, and all these things anyhow were huge. And then there was the transformation moment, which anyway came in an ayahuasca experience, which is another story. But
so that up until that point you were dealing with the grief of
the loss, the letting go, all the negative part of this. And it's like literally, it's just slowly, that kind of thing is, in a sense, it's like a way of thinking that's a poison killing me.
Yeah.
And then it's really
come more limiting than the actual physical.
Oh, absolutely.
Issues that you have.
Yes, because what has changed now, in a way, it's like, so then it's really, kind of, so the transformation in a way was, if you like, to turn around and be the opposite. And so to put all the concentration, all the energy to what I can do. I could still see, I could still talk, I could still smell, I could still do loads and loads and loads of things.
And ayahuasca helped you with that?
Well, the ayahuasca was the transformation.
How did you get introduced to ayahuasca at that point?
Just through somebody that I'd heard of it and I'd known of it for many years, but no interest, no desire to do it. And then this was I was in my low point with the arthritis, and I'd heard about it. And again, just the introduction to the yoga, it's just that moment, it just really felt, okay, it's time to do. And also, I never had an experience in my life where I was out of control. Like many people, they drink so much they can't remember where they were the night before. Or, I mean, I never had there was no drug culture in a kind of a sense, and I wasn't a big alcohol guy. So I never had this experience where I couldn't remember, you know, anything, as you know, some people that went through drugs or alcohol.
Or you lose control of the mind.
Yeah. Where I never had this experience. And I was really curious to know what it would be like.
Right.
So when I heard about the ayahuasca and to the experience, this is how I approached it. I thought, really, in a sense, I want to find out what the hell is it like to be out of control. So I approached the ayahuasca like this. So I was with a Peruvian medicine man. Eh? And so he is generous with the medicine, in a sense. So he offers 3 times. And so I went each time, three times during the ceremony for it. Holy Mac. Did I get what I was looking for? Yes, in that sense. That. So the experience essentially was my death.
It's your first time drinking it, the first night of the ceremony. Time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I drank it absolutely like a good Irishman as much as I know. I really went for it. I mightn't have done it with the alcohol, but I did it like that. And so it really took me to the place where literally I was having this well, it was literally as being like on the deathbed. And there was like physically on the outside, there was this sense of I was like a plank of wood, rigid, with absolutely rigid holding, complete rigidity. And the facilitators were there, like in a sense saying, okay, just let go, just relax. So, but then in the inside trip, the let go and the relax was because I was having this debate with myself about, like, in one sense, like, well, let go, relax, like, which was like, let go my last breath. That's what I was inside experiencing. And the debate was like, well, your life is shit here anyway. It's miserable. It's like you're just lying. Just let go. The next place, surely this is going to be better than here because of all my suffering. And so it was like, with all your suffering, it's like, what the hell are you holding on for? You really want to stay in this suffering, in this place? And that the next place, surely it's going to be better than this. So this debate was going on with myself. And in the meantime, it was the rigidity, because the let go to relax would be in my trip.
Yeah.
Eventually, anyway, I did let go. And the whole body softened. But I really felt as this wave of energy passed right through, as what I really felt was just like love. Just wave and that's it. And so anyway, then bit by bit, you come back. So the next morning, I was walking around for an hour or 2 hours outside. All I was really saying, I said, man, I'm so grateful to be alive. The depth, I kept repeating to myself, I'm so grateful to be alive, I'm so grateful. But the depth of which I felt the gratitude to be alive, this was so fucking scary of an experience. And it really woke me up to feel gratitude for being alive. And so that's the key, in a way. We're to feel grateful to be alive, in a sense. So that's like a seed, in a way, that nutrated. And that was also the shift from all the thing of like how miserable my life was. All my energy was going to the how miserable my life is, and not absolutely how wonderful, how great the life is. It's just a mind shift.
Yeah.
But also giving the energy, you don't always feel how great life is. We must actually begin to, because all the stimulation through the media and the news is everything, is all showing how shit. You look at the news any night and it's like, fucking man, it's all how terrible, how shit the whole life is. So all that inside is coming that way. So really must turn from it and start cultivating. But also inside me, I've been conditioned like with that way of thinking. So I must clean out that way of thinking and conditioning, but also turn and start to see and change inside myself, change my conditioning. And that's not so easy because it's ingrained so strong. But that's really it. And that's the transformation, to start to see, to come back to life again. That's I suppose, in a way. So that really is this typical, you might say, of like really dying. And so dying, I mean, there's the physical as we know it, but there's also all these parts of like letting go, principally, is really death. They're death experiences of things. And so that was anyway, from the transformation of an experience, and also like, I mean, what you call like a foundation of healing. It's like to begin, where do I put my energy? Where do I put my concentration? Or where? So it's a choice. Yep. You really decide. Somebody, you come there, I choose to concentrate to positive as opposed to negative, if you like, in a way.
How are the months after you've done your first ayahuasca session compared to the months before? Because you obviously went in with a lot of suffering and come out with a whole new appreciation for life. Did you find that how you experienced reality shifted massively?
No, I wouldn't. I don't have a memory or recollection of, you know, suddenly something has suddenly changed. And I'm also, my experience about these things is that I haven't, as in my way, experienced miracles. I mean, miracles is like you're crippled today and next thing you're running and you're playing football tomorrow. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's a miracle because there's no explanation whatsoever for it. These situations, I don't know. I hear of them. I don't know of any. I've no direct experience of that. So change is slow and it's incremental steps, yeah, is my experience. And so this ayahuasca was a profound shift. Like all the medicine is doing, it's showing me what is going on inside me.
Yeah.
It showed me so clearly. Look, man, you're putting all your direction, you're putting all your attention, you put your all energy into your loss about all what has happened to you. So you're making your life miserable. And so you look and feel grateful for the life. And so this made it crystal clear.
Yeah.
So then little by little, that's what I mean about practices. So to integrate
yeah,
it. No different than I imagine you, if it's like you hear sometime for some time a beautiful tune or a beautiful song or whatever, and it's like, I know you write your own, but we'll say, oh, I want to learn that. Yeah, you hear it and you're moved by it, but then you have to sit down and you have to make effort every day to practice it. And the more you'll practice it, I mean, the first time you, like when you'll play, we'll say somebody else's song or whatever like that, it will sound something. But the more you practice it and you feel into it, then the vibration of it that will come across to people gets deeper and all that. Mm-hmm. So it's the same kind of essence in a way.
Yeah.
Like to incorporate it, you got to practice. So making conscious efforts, like again, to turn, to see the life. And that's been going on since. It's not just as about a short time. So that's the other way that I feel to describe these plant medicine experiences. Like they take you on a helicopter ride up to the top of the mountain. And the top of the mountain, you see absolutely the beauty and all this. And then, okay, you come back down to the base. Now you walk up the mountain yourself. That's the integration, as you make the effort to walk up the mountain and you can get to the top, but you really must make effort to get there. And that's integration, and that's how I kind of see it, is that it's not a miracle. Is like you wake up next morning and it's completely changed and you don't have to do nothing. But that's the effort of it in a way that, but then you say about grounded, that's the grounding. It's really coming into your being. In a sense, it's filling up every cell in your body. It's not just only talk. That's a key part, I feel, with the plant medicine, because there's so much of it happening and going on now. It's insanely crazy. 99% of it, in my experience, is absolutely, it's just a replacement of cocaine and all the rest.
You think with the ayahuasca?
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah. 99%. So you think most?
100%. I have very strong feelings about that part.
So you think most people who are taking ayahuasca these days are just trying to replace it with another addictive, call it property?
I say most people, as you know, to tone myself down a small bit, or I could get cancelled.
Many
people in a kind of a way. Because it's in our Western culture. We do not have the experience of I'd say I encountered, like with the study of through the Japanese way of doing, like they take one thing and they study it, that one thing. If someone becomes a master of fasting
or sushi, whole life dedicated to a single discipline,
flower arranging, karate, whatever, they take that, and that's what they study. you go into like a karate or a tai chi or whatever these practices, and the guy who's there 20 years or the guy who's there the first week, they're doing exactly the same exercises. They're exactly the same kathas that they follow, but the difference of how the guy who's doing it for the first time and the guy who's doing 20 years is not the same. How it's inside in the understanding of the way of being is profoundly different. The plant medicine coming from the jungles in South America, this is traditions that's passed down for thousands of years unbroken, but learned with each new generation through practical experience, not through reading books and knowing about it this way. This is totally out of our realm.
Well, it's understanding and experience, isn't there?
Yeah, but it's like here, our way is two things we go to the developing world and we take their things and we bring them back, and like we've plundered, as like historically this is how we do, we take them and then we start to mix and match. We want to add this to this and this and this and this. And this. It's not that they're not good and they're not nice and they're not effective, but they're not very deep. Because I have six different therapies. I'm studying this and I'm studying that and I'm studying that. And it's like really the jack of all trades but the master of none. That's the fundamental difference. So we don't know. And somebody does, you know, a 6-week course or a 10-week course or whatever, and suddenly they're a yoga teacher and all this. This is not how these cultures think. We think you've done your 4 years in college or whatever, now you're a teacher. You're not at all a teacher. It's just like saying, you know, you've got a child born, now you're a father. You're not at all. Now you got just beginning. You know, after 20 years, okay, maybe you might know something about it before. But it's like, you know, that's how we are conditioned to think. So we think like that. But it's not true. It's more true and it's more correct that when the baby is born, you're just beginning. Now you'll find out. Not that you are a father, but we say it like that. We think it like that. But it's not like that. So that's why, in a sense, coming from that way is how I look about the thing. We look for the most part in a very incorrect way, and we so believe it is like that. Most of my experience tell me, no, it's not like that. If you come in the front door all the time, you see something, you say, oh, well, that's inside the front door. Come in the back door and you'll see the world from a whole different point of view. And start coming in the patio door and you'll see it from another world again.
Yeah.
Come down the chimney and you'll see it another world again. And that's really what we need to do, is to look from absolutely every direction, and then we might know something.
To entertain a different perspective.
And so there's a lot coming in a way to the medicine world and getting these ecstatic experiences, and now I know so we, in this sense, have to be super careful, super careful.
Yeah, hearing you talk about going away again, that's such like I mean, you're not in your 20s or 30s anymore. Like, it's kind of refreshing and inspiring to hear to me, because I know a lot of my 20s are built up with this anxiety of like, you got to do everything before you reach, you know, 30 or whatever it is, or else you won't ever get the chance to do it again. Whereas, it's just, for me, it's quite nice to hear of somebody an age like yourself and going off and doing these cool, exciting things.
But all them, they're conditioning thinking. That's the whole point of what I'm trying to make with it all. That's belief is put on you. That's the thing. That's what all is put on you. And people believe it. Loads of people believe it. But my experience through this is that it's not true. But it is true as long as I believe it. And that's back to the breaking of the beliefs when I talk, say, or my experience there about you know, you're woken up and you're shocked out with the food. You discover, I can manage without the sleep. I can manage without the food. It might be uncomfortable and all the rest, but no problem. But I won't die. And so that's what I mean, is like these thinkings, these beliefs, they're put on top of us. And that's what conditioning means, and so we believe them. Mm-hmm. And so the same, it's like in my time, it was like, you have to have your career when you're 18, you've got to figure out your career for the rest of your life. Yeah. Absolutely not. I mean, I've had 6 or 7, I don't know how many careers. In fact, I would say, change your career every couple of years. Way better. In that sense, and so this is it's all the conditioning is not, it's just limiting our infinite. I mean, we hear all the time about, oh, we only use this percentage of our, you know, our intellect or our capacity, I don't know, whatever it is, but then it is like a small amount of what's possible. But how do you start to use 50 or 60 or 70% of what we're capable of doing? You got to break through the boundaries that limit us.
Yeah,
that's the only way. It's the boundary. I mean, the closer the boundary are, I only use 5% of my capacity if my boundary is very close. But really, you burst the boundary and keep bursting the boundary, you'll start using 75% or 100% if you really tune. So I think that's the way why we have to keep breaking through, and that's. They're the difficulties in a way that we face every time, but they are about breaking through boundaries in a sense. And so, so have uncomfortable experiences. Embrace uncomfortable experiences.
Yeah. Because I know, Cuivin, you took a bit of a leap at an uncomfortable experience. You know, you went and sat with participated in a ceremony recently. Was that quite a confronting experience for yourself or... You know, taking that leap. I know that Eugene assisted or he was facilitating.
Yeah, it was for sure. There was definitely some uncomfortable moments, a lot, some tense moments like what Eugene was talking about just like holding on and that sort of thing. But it was a mixed bag for me, you know, like a mixture of beautiful, love-filled experiences and then other ones where I was quite like frayed and tense and stuff like that. Beautiful to see yourself and the way you conducted it was really beautiful. There was one question I was thinking of there when you were talking of plant medicines. Do you think like there's anything special about ayahuasca and San Pedro and stuff like that? Because I had experiences during my ayahuasca weekend that I've also had just on my own taking mushrooms or acid. And I've came to like the same sort of like realizations, you know, like you were talking about getting to the very top of the hill and seeing, you know, all of the beauty and like seeing what you need to do and that sort of thing. Like I've had those experiences on my own, just like messing around with other psychedelics. Do you think that there's anything inherently special that makes like ayahuasca and maybe San Pedro and the ones that come from South America better than the other ones, or are they all just tools to access the same sort of things?
They're tools. I suppose the only thing like to draw, say, from my experience around that is like, you know, when I've like smoked weed, you know, my experience with weed, but also like taking alcohol, like the environment with which I consume it is a huge influence. Like say with alcohol, I used to like to drink whiskey, I still like a little bit, but there are times where in an ambient, I could drink anyway, like say a lot of whiskey, you know, half a bottle of whiskey or whatever is drink. But not to get drunk, but just having a good time and the drink is going. And I wake up the next morning, and even like just a little bit of sleep, wake up the next morning, I'm buzzing, positive, ready to go. I could have one or two whiskeys, you know, and a full night's sleep, wake up with a headache the next morning. So same alcohol, same all that. So what it shows me, not just once, but many times this. And so what comes to me is that the ambient, the energy with which I consume it is a huge influence. So that's kind of one thing. Mm. Then like say with true, like say smoking weed is things when I smoke weed, what I kind of discovered is that, huge expansion. And great insights and great, you know, can invent loads of things and whatever. So this expansion, whatever like that. And think, oh yeah, this would be great to do and all exciting and that. But the reality is in the next days or two like that, nothing gets done. There's no, it's just like a great idea, but only talk in that time. Mm-hmm. And so I realized, okay, with this, no problem. Expand and be full of all, whatever like that, with the realization that, yes, none of it is going to happen. Anyway, yeah. In the time you think you have great ideas and it can happen with friends or whatever like that, you're going to do big plans together, but absolutely nothing happens. So this is the other part. So yes is the answer, you can have, but what do you do with them? You can in ceremony also with these plant medicines have all of this, but what you do with them, that's the key. I can keep coming back for the buzz of the experience, and I keep coming back. That's just the same as the habit of the addiction, right?
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, how do I integrate? The same thing comes like, even call it a yoga class. Oh, I feel so great when I do yoga, mm-hmm. but I got to keep coming back. But if I get to understand and get to feel, what is the essence behind it? What is the principles? What is it? And then from this, it's the key to me is to start to integrate it so that it becomes a habit. Like these teachings, that they get shown, but then there's practice in a way in the daily life in order to start to incorporate them so that they become part of me and I'm manifesting it in the daily life. So that's the absolute key. So if I say talk like in a way, yeah, of course, like joy is an uplifting energy and all that kind of stuff. But how do you do? It's like making a commitment that whatever I do, I do it with joy. So you start, if I set this as a goal or as an attitude or whatever, I start to move like this. So that's the key when you're with them. It's all about what I do and to start to incorporate them so they become part of me. I don't have to keep going for the fix.
Yeah.
That's the most essential part as what I feel. Otherwise, what's the point?
Mm-hmm. No, perfect. I'm just conscious of time. We kind of have to wrap up soon, but just two questions I'd love to ask you is, what advice would you give to anyone who's maybe considering taking medicine who hasn't taken it? What kind of input or thoughts would you have on that?
Choose very carefully who you do it with. Absolutely, 100%. It's potentially very dangerous. I mean, fine with yoga, you go to it. I mean, if it's a bad teacher or whatever, you pull a muscle or you put a disc out or whatever, you're not going to die. But in a way, with the plant medicine, you're really opening your soul. You're opening it to a spirit world and all of this. And you are going. Like one of the fears that many people, and well, me also, think that is that, you know, you get this expanded in part, and it's like, will I come back? It's like, really, I mean, you know, who hasn't in a sense? And it's one of our big fears of really of these things that we lose our mind, we go crazy. That's one of our big fears regarding our mind. Yeah. That we go crazy. It's a huge fear. But generally speaking. Yes, it's a thing. But then it's like you never know it until you start to do something where you expand and so it's like when you expand, it's like, will I come back? And that was my fear regarding the death. It was absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
I thought like, fuck man, I'm never gonna come back. Terrifying in a sense, but I did come back, and so you start to realize, okay, it's not that's just a fear. It's nothing more. But that's what the this part of really going to beyond. That's what I mean about going beyond our comfortable, our boundaries in that sense. I mean, we're afraid. We don't know what's on the other side of the wall. or in other words, there's a cliff and someone tells you, jump off the cliff, you'll be fine. You really, yeah. I mean, that's what, in a way, that's what I would, maybe the best way I would equate the medicine is I tell you, Darren, like, look, there's the cliff. Jump off that there, you'll be fine. And you think, oh, fuck, man. So if really you are to do that, you must 100% trust me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'd be
insane.
So trust
in the person
absolutely.
Is important, crucial.
Yes,
yeah, of
yes,
course.
Yes, yes, yes. Because that's what it is. You're opening your soul to something like that. Sure, and it does happen. People have a difficulty coming back. And so it does happen like that. And there's all kinds of offerings of with people with little or no experience in that. I mean, I'm doing 5 years. I wouldn't dream in a way to offer, to serve. I facilitate, I assist. But that's nothing in a way. That's like, it's a bit like, you know, I can be chopping vegetables for the cook, but the cook is the person who's making the meal in a kind of way. So there's a big difference between being the sous chef and being the guy who's helping and cleaning and washing dishes inside in the kitchen. So that's what I mean in a way. Maybe in 20 years' time or something, I would feel maybe I might be.
Yeah.
I'm not looking to do it.
Gotcha.
But so really, so that would be my biggest advice.
Yeah.
Be really very, very, choose very, very careful. And there's an awful lot of carry on going out there.
Yeah.
And it's a crazy world.
And yeah, absolutely. And it's probably one of the cases of having a kind of a legal, you know, in many regards. So you can have these trusted people and trusted environments as opposed to taking that risk. Mm. So yeah, thanks for that insight. Is there and then another question comes to mind, like, as a, you know, someone who's lived a well and wise life, is there any advice that you would give to someone maybe in their early 20s or who has a long road ahead of them, any wisdom that you would share?
Well, I would say I have lived an unwell life that's made me wise. So no, if you live a well life, you don't become so wise. I think it's like the unwellness.
True.
But anyway, that's what I mean. And the 20s. Oh, that's a big question. The parts that I do feel in a sense is like, like to really recognize you are responsible. It's your life. It's your life in that kind, especially in the early 20s and like this age, like you know, like teenage years is you are like before this, anyway, you are told what to do by your parents. Teenage years, you start to formulate your own opinions, ideas and thinking. So it's the part where you break away from your parents. Then you come to the early 20s, it's a bit like you're out on your own now and you find, oh, fuck, it's a big, bad world. And you keep running back to the parents to do your washing or when for comfort and all this kind of stuff, or if you're living with them. So there's still a battle because you're it's like you're a young adult and that. So you're also struggling with that identity. It's like now you have the possibility, you're on your own. It's fighting during the teenage years because you're still at home. But usually, if, in the sense of the early 20s, there is the sense that you're out of the home now. And it's like, oh, Jesus Christ, is this what it's like? But yet you have the conditioning in a kind of way. And some part, we want to reject this part with our parents because we get our conditioning from the socializing and from that. And so, and it's like, it's not mine. Most of all this what's put on me, the beliefs, I got them from my parents and school and all this kind of. So you're suddenly in your early 20s at this part, and that's the kind of work in a kind of a sense is that you are responsible. And so it's about taking responsibility, and that's huge. Many people go through their life and they don't fucking take any responsibility.
So responsibility, yes, like extreme ownership.
Yeah, but so I say taking responsibility, I might be say more as like to realize this is your life. There's nobody whatsoever to tell you what to do and how to do.
Yeah.
And so that's a huge part that means then I got to find out what is it that is me. Not the conditioning I got up. That's the heart of a lot of what I talk about is this thing of we're conditioned to believe stuff. I would say most of it is absolutely not true. It's not. And so to find out what is me, myself, and what is put on me as a conditioning and throw away that.
Great.
So that really you become. That's the work. And but that's not easy. And it's also why I think we take on so much like distractions. Distractions is absolutely huge. Most of what we are doing you know, kind of is distraction.
Yeah.
Because that work is absolutely huge to do, to find your own, like to go into the jungle, because that's what it is. You're going to the unknown.
Yeah.
Because the known is all what's put on me. Mm. But I'm not happy with it.
Yeah.
I want to myself find out who I am myself. And that's what the profound realization that this is my life. I can do whatever I like with it.
Yeah, so go into the unknown and challenge yourself. question all the beliefs and things that have been bestowed. Great.
Thank you. I mean, it's like I say that is absolutely huge in a kind of a sense.
Yeah.
It's nearly impossible. Like, in a way, like, this is one of the huge sort of things that's the loss. Like, that young people like that ought to have mentors to guide them through the process, to do it really well. Someone who's been there, in a sense, that's not telling you what to do, but that is like helping you to navigate. Because it's like literally you're going into the jungle. Well, somebody who's been into the jungle before will help you navigate.
Yeah.
It's not to stop you or to let you have your, what I call it, but anyway, to help you navigate, or you find out, or you want to ask because you don't know what you've seen in the jungle, whether it's going to kill you or whether it's going to give you life, whether you can eat it or whether it's going to poison you or give you life. You don't know in that kind of way. So mentors are lacking in a way, in a sense like that. So young people are lost. So you try to find it in drugs. That's how we try to do it. We try to find it in drugs. But we don't know how to navigate the drug world, so we keep doing again and again and again in a kind of a sense. Something like that, I feel, in a way.
No, thanks very much. Great
but
advice
there. But
there
are so few mentors there.
Yeah, we need more mentors for sure.
But also the thing is, like, a football star, a rock star already, who are absolutely shit human beings. They're great in a way, but we're talking about more a human condition. And a human thing.
Yeah.
They are shit at that, but it's how the model is out there.
Great.
But like real, true ones like that. I wish for more to be there or to anywhere.
Likewise.
But anyway, something like that is what I feel.
Thank you, I'm just conjuring, Quevin, have you any questions before we wrap up? Anything you'd like to ask?
No. I don't think so. No.
Look, thanks for your wisdom today. I think we could talk all day, you know.
Thanks for being here with us. And
thank you guys.
Hopefully Eugene can have a podcast of his own one day instead of on the last episode. But I think you got a lot to offer. And I know, like, as you were talking there in that last point, like, I do think, like, we need mentors and we need look to older, maybe wiser people to kind of guide us through the murky waters. And maybe that's a fact in, like, modern society. We don't actually value, we don't really look up to old people that much. You know what I mean?
Like, it's a huge
issue. We like value beauty and we always want people to be young and fresh, and like we put so much emphasis on that, whereas we don't maybe look forward to growing old, and we don't look up to older people. So I think
I think they're very very important.
I think we have one right here beside us. Like, and that was really when I went down and met you, like, I was like, this is, I've really been looking for someone like this, someone that's kind of on my path but is way ahead of where I am.
That's the kind of key. But it's like, it's good for both, because it's like you in here and thinking like, what, you see, I have a lot to offer. I think, like, really, really, I don't believe it. I mean, I know it, but I don't have a platform. I mean, I don't want, I'm not looking for egotistical in a kind of a way. There's loads of that carry on. But it's like we have a value for each other. So there's no hierarchy in a kind of, as
exchange.
Much as built like that.
It's an exchange.
It's absolutely exchange in a way. And that's the thing. Call it like this. I have this term called reciprocal prosperity. And so it's a beautiful part, like, it's reciprocal prosperity. So in a way, we are both prospering. That's the part, you know.
Yeah.
And like that. So really, it is an exchange to find out, and essentially, at the, you word the word value. That's it. Where, that's a big problem. Like, my generation only criticize the young people coming up, oh, they're like this, that, and the other. Really, fuck you. Really, if you want, how do you want them to grow? To be like shit? Or you want them to grow and to be something beautiful? Yeah. Value them. nurture them, feed them, you know, good food, not poison, yeah, with this kind of mentality. And so that's the, that's what I feel is that this, that it's totally broken down and it's lost and all that. But that, that there is this kind of, being together and that, and so a key in all of that is we must work and take out the judge and the critic.
Yeah.
These are the two
empathy,
big ones.
Empathy and understanding, you know, that's the way I think. Critical thinking.
Critical thinking as opposed to critic.
Critical thinking and empathy as opposed to judgment.
And well, that's a whole other, we've got a whole podcast about the judge and the critic.
Yes, but look, thank you so much for coming on, Eugene. Appreciate it, Quavin. Yeah. Thanks very much. Yeah. It's been a pleasure. Good to have you there. And lots of nice insights and wisdom. So, thanks very much, guys.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I hope.
I hope it is of value to somebody. Even if it's one person, it would be beautiful.
I think there's lots of value in there. And I think there's lots of thought-provoking content. Yeah. So thank you.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. Just participate in a bit of history. Eugene's first podcast.
Yeah. Great. Thanks very much for tuning in. Thanks for tuning in, guys. And much love.